Welcome, 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 everybody, to the Her Story Circle podcast. This is Gertrude Mache here in beautiful Wellington, New Zealand. Welcome to the only podcast that is dedicated to bringing you inspirational stories from women from all over the world. Our stories range from business and entrepreneurship, health and wellness, family and relationships, creativity, spirituality, and social justice. All these phenomenal women have one thing in common. We believe that we can change the world one story at a time, one woman at a time, by honoring our stories and our personal experiences, and sharing our successes and failures, and transmuting our trials and tribulations in life into learnings and the stepping stones to our future success. Our vision is to inspire, uplift, empower, collaborate, and impart the knowledge that we have gained through our personal experiences.
My name is Tiffany Jackman. I am based in the New York City area.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Her Story TV and the Her Story podcast. This is Gertrude Mache here in beautiful Wellington, New Zealand, and I am graced with the presence of a very creative young woman coming to us all the way from the US. Welcome to our tribe. Please tell everybody your full name, where you're based, how old you are, and share your magical story with us today.
Well, thank you for having me. My name is Tiffany Jackman. I am based in the New York City area. So I live in New Jersey, but pretty much live in New York City. I am a filmmaker. I'm a writer, director, producer, and I have loved storytelling from the time I was a very, very little girl. I always tell this story that when I was little, I used to take my dolls, and not just like any little kid, every little kid plays with dolls, but I used to take my dolls and turn them into TV shows. And I'm the oldest of four girls, and I used to force my little sisters to watch my shows. They had theme songs and everything. So I like to come up with stories from the time I was a teeny, teeny little girl. I also used to like to write plays, and I used to write them for my classmates to perform. And the plays, people used to love the plays. But one of the frustrations I had was that the plays couldn't be consistent. You know, sometimes somebody would forget their line, or a piece of the set would fall. So I don't know, so many reasons. And then someone suggested, why don't you just film it so that when it's done right, it will stay that way forever. And so when I was 12 years old, I got my first camera, and I've been making little movies ever since. I went to NYU and went through their film program. Upon graduating, I studied film directing and producing when I was at NYU. But upon graduating, I actually got an internship at an ad agency. And so that's how I started my career, really doing commercials for these big name clients, like CoverGirl, E-Trade, Advil, Robitussin, all these huge companies. I started doing commercials for them, but on the side, I was still doing my movies because that's where my passion lied. And eventually one of the movies got onto HBO, got onto Amazon Prime, and we're making the film festival circuit. And so I eventually came to the realization that I couldn't, if I was making this much success, you know, in my downtime, my vacation days, I need to go full-fledged and just see what I can do if I actually jumped off the corporate ladder and focus on my passion. And so about 2 years ago, I decided to leave my corporate job and follow my film career. And I haven't looked back since. Actually, while I was leaving, one of my good friends, Howard Bowler, who ran Hobo Audio, I told him that, you know, I was leaving on Friday, and he asked me if I could work on a TV pilot that he had been working on. And I was like, well, sure. I mean, I'm leaving my job. Why not? And so I worked with him on this pilot called The System, because I love the storyline. And that one has gained it got distribution on Quelly TV. And then we started working on other stuff together, and I'm officially launching with Howard Hobo Films. So he already had an audio company called Hobo Audio, and now I'm the head of development at Hobo Films. We did the system, and we recently did this powerful documentary called Crawford, The Man the South Forgot. And I'm so proud of how it came out, because it was an adventure pulling it together.
Wow, what an incredible journey you've been on.
Thank you. What I love
most about your story is you knew what your passion in life really was from a very early age. Some people don't get to discover it that early, but you knew what it was. You went into the corporate world, didn't feel right, and you plucked up the courage to, like you said, leap off the corporate ladder. If you were to talk to somebody right now who is trying to make a decision like that, based on what life has taught you in the last 2 years, what three nuggets of advice would you give that person to take the leap?
I would say, find out what your passion is and just do it. Find out what your passion is, trust your gut, and just do it. Because when I was leaving my job, there were very good jobs that I worked for. So I didn't leave on any type of bad terms or anything like that. It's just that I needed to follow my passion. And as I was leaving, I was going around and telling, you know, my coworkers that, hey, you know, I'm leaving. And one of the first things they ask you is, well, where are you going? Like, everybody assumed you're just going to go to another corporate job. And when I told them that I was leaving, and that I was going to just follow my passion, so many of them started telling me about their passions and what they really wanted to do. And I would see this light in their eyes when they talked about, like, maybe they wanted to be a musician, maybe they wanted to paint or whatever. And then the light will go out when they say something like, oh, well, but then reality set in and they had kids or whatever reason that they needed to stay in this job. And it was very sad. And all I could tell them was that, you can still do it. There's still time. So I would say the biggest thing is just do it. And the proof of what happens when you actually just follow your passion, right, is that since I've left, I haven't had to go back and things have fallen into place. Even the whole thing with how it worked out with Howard Bowler, the way I knew Hobo Audio is because while I was doing my commercials, we would contract Hobo Audio to do the audio work for those commercials. So they would do the music, the sound effects, the voiceover records. So I'd been working with Howard for years, and he also would help me with my feature films as well, with my side projects. And so when it came time to leave, I didn't even have to ask him for anything. He just saw the passion that I had put into my work and asked me to work with him. So far, since I've left, I haven't had to interview or ask for anything. It's because I was following my passion, everything fell into place. But I say the first thing is just do it. Trust your gut. I would say I think I gave that second one, but the last one I would say is just because you want to make that leap doesn't mean that you should just make it without planning it. When I decided that I was going to leave my job, it actually, from the time I made the decision, it was actually a year's process in the making for me to actually leave. I made sure that I had at least a year of savings saved up, because you can't just think that your passion is going to start making you money right away, right?
Yes.
I started building my clientele, because I also have been using like what I learned in advertising to do work for small businesses.
Yes.
So I had to start building that up as well. So you have to make an exit strategy. You can't just leave.
That's wonderful. Now, I know that a lot of your work is based around social justice stories, and you have worked on some phenomenal pieces. Tell us a little bit about your latest venture.
Yeah. So I always ask myself whenever I'm doing a project, before I sign on to things, I always ask myself, why does this story need to be told? Who can it help? Because I went to film school, So I have friends that are working on all types of projects. They're working on the Avengers movies or all these big budget things, which is cool, you know, not knocking any of that. But I choose to work on things that I think can impact people. Right. So in regards to Crawford, the Man the South Forgot, this story is about a woman who journeys back to a historically racist Southern town. She lives in Chicago. She journeys back to a historically racist Southern town to find out what happened to her great-great-grandfather, because she's heard all these stories about how he was so successful and, you know, how the family had their own business and they were so popular, but that something had happened to him. So her journey is to go back and find out what happened to him, find that connection to him. And the story, her grandfather, his name was Anthony Crawford. And there's some debate whether or not he was born a slave or born right after slavery ended. But either way, he came from humble beginnings to owning over 427 acres of prime cotton land. Wow. And back then, right at the turn of the 20th century, owning cotton land was basically like owning gold, because that is what the country was run on at that time. So he amassed this large farm. He farmed it with his 13 children, and they grew cotton. They had animals. They grew crops. He ended up building a school. He headed a church. Like he was a pillar in the community. And as a Black man, someone who was a former slave or just born after slavery, that was a huge accomplishment. But, you know, with that, he had pride about him. And there's something that comes with being an entrepreneur where you don't take anything from anybody because you don't have a boss, right? And so he had pride about him, and he was quoted as once saying, "The day a white man hits me is the day I die," which just proves that he wasn't going to let anybody talk down to him. He wasn't going to let anybody hit him. And so fast forward to October 21st, 1916, he took his cotton into town to sell it, and he was underbid by a white merchant. A white merchant offered him less than what he was offering some of the other merchants. And he told that merchant, you're cheating me. He called him a cheat. And well, that was all they needed, because there were already some people who were quite jealous of him. And a mob of between 200 and 400 people beat him, stabbed him, took his body, drug it all throughout town, and then hung his body on a tree and shot it over 200 times. And if that's not horrific enough, they went to his family and told him they have 30 days to get off the land or that they would be killed as well. And so his family ended up dispersing all over the U.S. Some went to New York, some went to Philadelphia, some went to Chicago, where our protagonist, Doria D. Johnson, where her family ended up. And the family was split up, and till this day, they don't have any proceeds from that land. That land is owned by a paper company. And so she, you know, being that they were dispersed, the family was kind of torn apart. She had heard these rumors about this great-great-grandfather that she had, and she wanted to find out more about him. And the documentary follows her as she goes back to that town and to try to get that town to recognize what happened to him.
Wow. What a tragic story.
Yeah.
But again, these are the untold stories that go unseen, unheard, unless somebody takes time to shine a light on them.
Exactly. Wow. And that's what us at Hobo Films, that's what we're trying to do, is shine a light on some of these stories, because there are so many stories out there. I'm tired of seeing the same story on TV all the time.
Yeah, that's so true. Do you think there could be reparations that could come out of the exposure of this kind of a story?
I mean, I would love for reparations to happen. It like, if not for Black people, Black Americans in general, but at least for this family.
Yeah.
They deserve to have something from that land. I actually went down there, and you know, I'd been hearing about 427 acres and stuff as I was editing the film. But when I actually went down there to visit his land, I had to take a car from one end to another. And just seeing how much land that was, it was very upsetting, because I was like, wow, this family does not have access to this land.
Anything.
And what it's worth. Yeah, anything. It was taken over by pretty much the people who killed him.
Gosh.
And now it's owned by a paper company.
Yeah, that it's, you know, from a distance, being a person of African descent, I have always looked on the tragedy of the African-American story. Mm-hmm. We hear about these things. We are so far away from it. It wasn't until I came and lived in the U.S. for a while that I got to experience what it is to be Black in America.
Right.
We hear the stories, but it's not the same when you're actually physically there. So I lived in Pittsburgh for a while. I lived in New Mexico. And the ignorance, even in the United States, about the history. And it's mostly because most of this history has been written out of the history books. So most kids grow up without a clue of what actually happened or what is still going on within the country. So I think it's really important that storytellers continue telling the real story and not just glossing things over. So now with the Black Lives Matter movement, mm-hmm. I think there is an opportunity for people like you to go back and redress the past.
Yes.
Somebody said to me the other day, oh, you know, I'm really sad with what's going on in the United States. And I think it's actually perfect. The previous regime, the Trump legacy, was a catalyst for change. People were under the impression that the civil rights movement had solved the issues with race relations issues in the United States, and it wasn't true. And it's like somebody had slapped a Band-Aid over a septic sore and said, everything is fine. You know, we've dealt with it. And this wound has been festering under the surface. And Donald Trump came up and pulled off the Band-Aid and exposed what's really there. And now it's a time for Americans to heal, to go back into those wounds and address them. You know, when you watch a man being murdered by a policeman on screen, we've seen so many of these deaths and nobody's held accountable to it. The policemen walk off scot-free. The police are supposed to be the protectors of a community or for society. And that's not the case in the U.S.
No, not at all. It's because in the U.S., the police started off as the slave patrols. So yeah. How could they be a protector of Black people if their origins are in oppressing Black people? That's a whole nother conversation. But
it's another conversation, yeah.
Yeah.
And the prison system, from what I see, is just another form of slavery. I used to watch, you know, American Westerns. So I'm from Zimbabwe originally, mm-hmm. and the bounty hunters and all of that. It's just the same thing. They have a certain quota. They have to catch enough people to keep the prisons going. I mean, nowhere else in the world is the prison system privatized. I mean, if you privatize a prison system, you need people in the prison so they can make money. It's such a bizarre thing to watch from a distance, mm-hmm. and yet it's considered very normal in the United States. It's like, I don't get it. I really.
Yeah, they're just so used to it that they don't know any other way, you know? But that's, like I said, that's a whole nother discussion. The prison system should not be privatized. I don't think that the police should be making money. The police shouldn't be making money. The police system should not be a way of making money for the government. They should not be getting money for the number of people that they lock up. They shouldn't even be getting money for the number of parking tickets they write. They should literally be there to protect and to serve. But because there's so much tied, they make so much money off of the what the police officers do, it harms the community at the end of the day. It makes them stop people for stupid reasons, you know? It's crazy. That I think the whole system needs to be revamped.
Yeah. Well, I really thank you for coming and shining a light on a very important issue in the United States. Thank you for the work that you do in telling these stories, the untold stories that people never get to hear about. And I hope that through your work, things will change. I know that we can change the world one story at a time, one person at a time. And that's basically what you're working on as well.
Thank you so much. And thank you for giving me the time to and the platform to talk about these stories. I really appreciate it.
It is an absolute pleasure. And thank you to everybody who tuned in today. Our platform is trying to connect, uplift, inspire women, people all over the world, one story at a time, one day at a time. Sometimes you'll come onto this platform and you'll hear a story that will shock you. And I know for a lot of people in the US listening right now, you might not have known about these kind of stories and you've lived there your whole life. So I hope you have taken this particular story with empathy, putting yourself in the shoes of this family, the Crawford family, what they went through, what they lost, what their great grandfather had created as a legacy for his family that is just completely gone. How would you feel if it was you? I think when we infuse empathy in our listening, we can change the world. So thank you again. I'll be back again tomorrow with yet another amazing story. This is Gertrude Macha here in beautiful Wellington, New Zealand. Have a fantastic day wherever you are in the world. Bye for now. Thank you, Tiffany.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
If you would like to support the Her Story Circle so that we can curate more fascinating and intriguing stories around business and entrepreneurship, health and wellness, family and relationships, creativity, social justice, and spirituality, hit the donate button on the herstorycircle.com website, and this will help us reach more women and share these fascinating stories with you every single day. Thank you so much for your support. Thank you for listening in.
My name is Elaine Party. I'm based out of Rochester, Minnesota, and I'm 55 years old.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Her Story TV and the Her Story podcast. This is Gertrude Macha here in beautiful Wellington, New Zealand. And today we are blessed with the presence of yet another phenomenal woman coming to us all the way from the US. Welcome to our tribe. Please tell everybody your full name, where you're based, how old you are, and share your story with us today.
So my name is Elaine Party. I'm based out of Rochester, Minnesota, and I'm 55 years old. And to share a little bit about what I am working on, I am interested in how humans and animals connect us. And so how I kind of got installed in that thought process was because I had a therapy dog. And I saw that interaction between people that were older in hospice care and my dog, and seeing how important that was in people's lives. So from there, I had different ideas about, you know, how this might be important in other people's lives. But it wasn't until just this past year, when my father was diagnosed and placed in hospice care, and my dog went to visit my dad, that I really truly understood from both sides of the story what it's like to have your be an animal provider to someone who needs it and be the recipient of who the animal comes to. Because they were interacting in a way I've never seen before. When I was probably 10 years old, I wanted a dog more than anything. And my dad was like, no, we're not going to have a dog. You know, that's, we're not the dog family. My mom, the same way, she was not a big pet person. So I went through life without a dog until I got married. And then we did get a dog. And so seeing my dad at 95 years old with my golden retriever, singing to her while he was at the end stages of his life was so impactful that I knew that there was going to be more to this journey. And I lost my dog about a week after that, very unexpectedly. She passed away within 8 hours after getting sick. So heart-wrenching to see that happen. And I've, in her memory and now my dad's memory, I really just feel that this is really an important mission to come alive and make this happen for people. So I've taken what I've learned in the last period of time, a lot over COVID while we were here, kind of hunkered down, and spent a lot of time looking at research, looking at pet industry people that were, you know, aligned with this kind of a thought process. And so now I'm starting to, with other people, join in to like combine people in a platform that allows for businesses, nonprofits, scientific research to all come together to really help people understand how animals can really participate in our lives in really unique ways. And this is a gamut of different ways. So it's from school age kids to hospice, to people in the military, to individuals that are sick, people that just have mental illness and stress that need an animal to support them. There's a multiple different ways. So I'm really excited to have this opportunity to make this come alive for people and make a difference in their life. So,
wow. What a story. So this really goes back to you, your personal experience as a child, not getting access to a pet, but having the pleasure of owning a pet in your formative life, which is really fantastic.
Yeah, yeah.
And so the animal did have an impact on your father as well, by the sound of it.
So, yeah, I mean, you know, as my dad was coming out the door to see my dog, Lily, I had to like pull her around because he was just 95 year old and his eyes were lit up like it was Christmas. Like he was just amazed, you know, he was like wanting to get out there, wanting to see her as soon as he could. And I had to take her around the side of the garage because we had to get him down the stairs safely. And so then when we got them together, he started singing to her and like, you know, Lily, I love you. Lily, I love you. And so, you know, it's just a really great interaction and seeing both sides of the story, being the, you know, my parents and also the handler of the dog. It was just something that really brought that 360. So
now what is it about pets that helps human beings in life? Based on your personal experience.
Yeah. So I am a nurse also. So I have seen different instances that have brought pets to the bedside of patients. And just that feeling of love, like unconditional love, unconditional support, wanting to cuddle, no words, just being there, being present is so important for people to have that opportunity, especially if they're going through some type of illness where they just, they don't need anything more than just having something for comfort. And a pet really does offer that peace. So
it's just awesome. So where do you see this movement going? Tell me the vision and the mission and how you're rolling it out throughout the United States.
Sure. So in 2019, I worked on a TV program that was going to be launched in the fall of 2020. And so I started to see, you know, with that, working on sponsorships and talking to pet industry people, I loved the pet industry people. And so I kept in contact with them because at one point the show did shut down because of COVID. And so we we had connections and had people we had kind of based ideas with. And so just continuing to kind of flow through that back in, you know, so it took us about a year to kind of go through after that of trying to think about what this might be. Would it be a nonprofit? Would it be a business? So we reached out to our local state Minnesota nonprofit organization to get some guidance because we kind of knew we wanted to get things moving, and we weren't interested in having it business-based at this point, and we wanted to do it sooner than we could with the forming a nonprofit and getting a board together and all the steps that would be responsible under that platform. So they recommended we could do some umbrella projects under nonprofits. And we have that concept and we're ready to go through with that. And we've wanted to get a little bit of momentum moving. People here in Rochester know me. They are very aware of different things that I've been involved in and the success of that. But we really wanted to get that outreach a little bit farther. So we started with a small campaign, a book drive to align with a nonprofit up in Minneapolis that works with kids in Southeast Minneapolis to get books into their hands and read with dogs. So we did that. And so now we're at the point where people are starting to generate more energy around us. We're making more connections in the pet industry and also supportive interactions. So our plan is we are a pro bono team who work together to bring stories about animal bonds via events or projects. And our idea is to approach businesses that want to be involved in corporate responsibility and nonprofits that need the help and kind of be like the matchmaker there, be able to connect them to the business side, to things that align with their values and their mission. And then help the nonprofit by getting them to cooperate, you know, together and do projects together that we have kind of focused on. We'll help create some of those programs. We'll be moving forward over the summer here to look at health and happiness that dogs and animals bring into our lives, talking about the health benefits, talking about school situations that might be good for animals. Work scenarios. There are a lot of corporations that bring pets into their workplace to allow their employees to be a little bit happier and healthier. And then we'll be marching through more campaigns. One that we do really want to focus on is the military, military service and family. So support through animal therapy will be another highlighted focus we have coming forward. Wow. And probably the one that has excited us some recently is really incorporating schools and mindful practice with animals. So a combination of that where we're bringing some mindful practices in and partnering them with animals, which is going to be kind of a new concept that we just kind of found out about and seen some research about and really think that that would be a great thing because that can be you know, a large variety of people that can be impacted by mindful practices. So,
wow, it's quite a wide scope and so many areas of need. You know, I'd never really thought about the military families in that sense. You know, when a mother or a father goes away on duty, the impact it has on the kids.
Right. So we're trying to kind of approach some of that. And really just, like I said, heighten awareness because of so many people that have military or have dogs that could go into military facilities. Mm-hmm. There is, you know, our great vision would be to get a military dog, animal therapy dog on each base, you know, so that we have connected with a chaplain in an Iowa base, National Guard facility, and he's shared with us that he has a dog that he's currently working with, and that's really been helpful for them to be able to help families and the military themselves. So it's kind of neat. He brings the dog around with them, so and a vision of something that we would love to see happen, that would be one of our visions, is to have a military dog service representation at each base.
That is just phenomenal. Thank you so much for coming online and sharing the story with us today. It's just incredible. Welcome. The work that you're doing, the joy that you're bringing as well.
And, yes, we're excited. And I think it will open people's eyes. Sometimes I think it's hard to know stuff that you're not familiar with. So my thought is always just to really educate and inspire people. And, you know, there'll be lots of good that will happen from this, and we will make a difference.
So. Wonderful. And what is the name of your website? Where can people check out the work you're doing?
Sure. It's Animals Connect Everyone. So animalsconnecteverybody.com. Okay. And we have our social medias there too. So you can click on that to find out more information. We're always looking for stories, and we're always looking for additional volunteers to help us.
Yes.
As we have different things that we'll be rolling out that we'll need assistance with. So if it touches somebody's heart and they like what they're hearing, please feel free to reach out to us.
Wonderful. I'll put all of your handles on this interview. Thank you so much for gracing us with your presence, and good luck with this project.
Thank you.
And thank you, everybody who's tuned in today. If you are an animal lover, or if you're not and haven't even explored it yet, I think this is going to be worthwhile checking out. Thank you for tuning in. This is Gertrude Mache here. Have a fantastic day wherever you are in the world. Bye for now. Thanks, Elaine.
The Her Story Circle is a social impact project focused primarily on women and children around the globe. We raise money by curating all of these amazing stories into a series of books, an anthology series where we publish 10 stories in every volume. So you can support us by buying the books. You can support us by donating towards this podcast. You can support us by sponsoring some of the social impact projects that we have highlighted on our website. The link to all our projects is the herstorycircle.com/projects. Our projects range from business initiatives where we set up women's cooperatives and help women get out of poverty. We help people who are helping in their communities. It could be that woman who started a soup kitchen and is helping feed the homeless because of the COVID pandemic. We support women who are focused around the elderly, the homeless, and the disabled. So feel free to go onto the herstorycircle.com website, go into our project section, and see what could inspire you to be part of our circle. Thank you so much. Looking forward to connecting with you. A special thanks goes to our main sponsor, SkinnyTees.com, based in Detroit, Michigan. Linda Schlesinger Wagner is an amazing woman who shared a story of how she created this amazing business at the age of 63. When she heard the vision behind the Her Story Circle, she became our main sponsor, and I would love you to go onto her website, check out her amazing t-shirts that suit every woman, every age, every size. The website is skinnytees.com. Please support this amazing sponsor who is helping us bring these fascinating stories to you every single day. Thank you, Linda.
My name is Michelle Fishburn, and I am based in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, in the United States.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Her Story podcast and the Her Story TV. This is Gertrude Macha here in beautiful Wellington, New Zealand, and I'm graced with the presence of yet another fascinating lady coming to us from the US. Welcome to our tribe. Tell everybody your full name, where you're based, how old you are, and share your story with us today.
Sure. My name is Michelle Fishburn, and I am based in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, in the United States, and I am 58 years old. And the word based in North Carolina, that phrase based, really sort of sets the stage for everything. Because what I would normally say is, oh, I live in. But I actually don't live anywhere right now. And I haven't ever since September 2020. When 2020 started, I was just like everybody else. I had a job, which I loved. I did public relations for nonprofits. And I had a house. And I had a daughter who was a senior in high school. So that in the United States, that's the last year before college. And so my January 2020 was very normal. Things started out normally. And then by the middle of July, when I had lost my job in the COVID spring, I submitted 86 customized cover letters and I had nothing. And this is for somebody who went to a good college, good law school, had part of an MBA, had been an international trade attorney flying all over the world. And I had nothing. And so by the middle of July, no job. And then the lease on the post-divorce house was coming up on July 31st. And my youngest was going off to college. So I sat in a parking lot of Target here in the United States around the middle of July. And I thought, where am I going to tell the movers to put my stuff? So it was a very tangible, very simple dilemma that I had, which is, when the movers come on July 31st, where do I tell them to move my stuff to? And that was the moment I had to decide. And I thought, well, if I don't have a job, I shouldn't rent someplace to live. I don't know where I'm going to live. So I don't have a house. I don't have a job, but I do have a motorhome, a 2006 motorhome, because I homeschooled my kids. And during that time, I road schooled them once for 10 months in my motorhome and once for 4 months. And so I thought, all right, I'll move into the motorhome. And then I thought, well, what am I going to do with myself? And I was really, really curious about who we are now, which is the name of my project, who Americans were at this moment in 2020 with everything going on and with a pandemic. And I thought, I'll just drive around the United States and interview people and put their stories up on a website. And I did that. I started in September 2020, 12,000 miles later, at the end of March, I had interviewed hundreds of people from a wide range of America. And then UNC Press said, can we make this into a book? So now I have a book coming out and I have found a newfound pleasure, which is everybody around me. And I can't wait to continue this new chapter of my life of cranking out book after book after I interview lots and lots of people in different parts of life, different experiences. And so I think this is the beginning of me becoming a serial author.
Your story is absolutely amazing. No, I thought I was crazy. I have met my match. This is incredible. But you know, what you've done is you've harnessed the power of stories.
Yes.
And you transmuted what looked like a bleak, dark experience into something absolutely magical.
And I didn't understand the power of stories. Even though I did public relations and I shared out stories as part of my job, I didn't really understand it, frankly, until I interviewed somebody who works on a mental health project in New York City last week. And what she said is, what happened with the pandemic is, since it was something that we were all facing, something that was a very natural thing to make us feel scared or lonely or isolated or depressed. Since we all were sharing the same thing, it took the stigma out of having negative feelings about something that was confronting you in life. And they had set up a virtual free for 1 month mental health project. And what they found was that people really wanted to do the groups. Even though they had free sessions one-on-one, they're like, no, thank you. And this is a quote, I want to hear how others are getting through this. And when you extrapolate that very interesting piece of information, more generally, now I understand the power stories. Now I understand why people have been asking me to speak and people have been thrilled with me sharing out these stories, is because it helps us all see each other trying to get through this thing we call life.
So the pandemic is really a shared experience. You know, I moved to New Zealand 21 years ago. Coming from Southern Africa, I'm from Zimbabwe originally, and this is my second pandemic. And I remember when I would talk about the AIDS pandemic and the impact it had on me personally. You know, Michelle, my grandmother had 11 children. She had 34 grandchildren. 19 of my first cousins died of AIDS, including my baby brother. And I would tell these stories and I would see people's eyes glaze over like I was telling a fiction story. Is it really true? And I remember sharing a story of going to a graveyard the week before I came to New Zealand. I buried one of my cousins the week before. And I go back to the same graveyard with two bunches of flowers. And I had to walk 2 kilometers to find the previous grave a week before. And it felt like we were in the middle of a war and there was no war. And now the visuals are all over the world. There isn't a country that hasn't been impacted and touched by what has happened to us as a collective. So COVID in a weird way has united humanity from my perspective.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It has.
It's given us a shared experience, right?
It has. And, you know, one of the things that I thought when I first set out is that people were going to feel despair and feel despondent and depressed. Right. That's what I expected to find. Mm-hmm. But what I found instead is an old word, is pluck. And pluck means spirited and determined courage. And when I think of pluck, there are 2 images that come to mind. One is the people in Italy on their balconies, singing, yes, pounding pans, playing instruments. That's pluck. Like, oh yeah, this is coming at us, but we got this, right? And then the other, my other image is of this young woman named Anaya Gregory from Missouri in the United States. And she was turning 21 during the pandemic. And she said, I've always, all my life, 21, right? All my life, I wanted to start a company in fashion. And this was my 21st year. I needed to do something big. And so I didn't let the pandemic stop me. So she started an e-commerce fashion business. and her motto was, embrace the uncomfortable and walk with purpose. And I think that's just another beautiful way to visualize what pluck means. We have embraced the uncomfortable and we have walked with purpose, with spirited and determined courage.
But there's some people who are not coping, Michelle. There's some people who are not seeing the opportunity. You know, I was reading I can't even remember. It was a quote that said the Chinese write the word for crisis with 2 symbols, dangerous opportunity.
Hmm.
So some people are just seeing the danger in what is happening. Other people are seeing the opportunity in what's happening. And I feel like people are more connected now than ever. And if you're an entrepreneur and you want to start a business, this is the time to be doing that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's just an incredible experience.
Well, so a couple things on that. One thing that has surprised me is, you know, we all get so tied up with our lives and we're busy, 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 at least here in the United States. That seems to, like, the busier you are, the more value apparently society thinks you have.
Or perception of value.
I know. That's another day. And then we all had to slow down. And in the slowing down, it's almost as if we kind of lifted up our chins and our eyes. And we thought, what about the people over there? And so, and I did about 300 interviews. And so many people said to me after the interview, how are people doing? I've been thinking about the people under these conditions. Like I talked to one guy who has a cattle ranch in Texas. And he said to me, have you talked to anybody in New York? I've been wondering about the restaurant owners in New York. Now that kind of dialogue, that kind of moment of really not in a big fanfare way, but of quietly wondering about the other. I think I've seen more of that.
Yes. Wow. Wow. That is just incredible. That is just incredible. And that's the human spirit rising to the occasion and just forging on regardless of everything that is coming against us right now. Now, there's a lot of grieving. There's a lot of loss. Yeah. You know, I lost my mother-in-law on the 29th of March. I had just lost my dad the year before. 3 weeks later, my mother died. 2 months later, my daughter had a miscarriage. And just dealing with the grief, just one incident after another. How are people coping with grief from your perspective?
And maybe it's because, and so I don't know if it's artificial or not. I've wondered about this because when I say to somebody, will you share your story? Yes. Sometimes people have had heart-wrenching stories to share, but they're right there in front of me telling me and hoping for a better tomorrow. And I know that sounds a little Pollyannish, but for example, one gentleman, he was a denier and he brought COVID into his house and he killed his father-in-law and he feels like he killed his father-in-law. And he was still struggling and there was nothing I could say to take that burden off of him. There was another family who lost a 39-year-old son who had been living by himself for a little bit and just called his wife and said, I think I've got the flu. And that was on a Saturday. And when he didn't show up to something on Sunday, the friends came over and he was gone. And they got a call out of the blue. And, but they, I said, you don't have to tell your story. It's fine. And they said, no, we want to tell our story. And one of the things that drove them to sharing their loss is we want people to know this is real. And so there's that, right? They felt like out of their loss, they at least wanted people to hear that there's danger out there that's real and it's not a hoax. And they felt like they said to me, if we could, by sharing our story, if we could help some other people avoid the pain that we have felt. We
and
want
his death
to
would have been
that.
Worthwhile. Yeah. Wow.
And I think that the United States is in a very fortunate place right now, obviously, with a rate of vaccines. And I would say that about 50% of the people I've spoken with recently, after they said, well, I'm so glad to have a vaccine. And then they pause and they say, but India.
And developing countries are in a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
And we don't even hear the half of it. You know, I'm from Zimbabwe. I talked to my brother and he was saying the deaths that are being reported aren't accurate. Ministry of Health doesn't go into the villages. We have no idea how many have died. And you're right. There are countries that are more fortunate than others. And in Africa, they are getting the third generation vaccines. It's not what you guys are getting in the States.
Yeah.
So the impact is even bigger there. Where do you think this is all going, Michelle?
I spoke to a woman named Gabrielle Fitzgerald, who started the Pandemic Action Network. And she started really caring about the cycle of panic and neglect that's often associated with pandemics. And she was involved in the with the Ebola virus in West Africa in 2014, 2015. And she thought we had learned our lessons then and that changes would be made. And she said, you know, the ironic thing, Michelle, is that in October 2019, I was involved in a simulation of a novel coronavirus outbreak. And in the simulation, virtual, there was a global pandemics council. And she said, I remember thinking after the simulation, this simulation is artificial because there is no such council. So really, we keep cycling through this. And the question, I think, is this the moment where we do something not incremental? That's above my pay grade. What I know, what I know is that people do feel more connected. They are seeing each other in a different way than before. Whether that leads to big change or we've just go, phew, dodge that one and we move on, I don't know. I mean, my book is coming out in 2022. Who We Are Now, What We Lost and Found During the Pandemic. And I really hope that we continue to have discussions, to having my book out there, to having other people's work out there, to looking at the oral histories that have been collected all over the world, that we can keep the discussion alive and understand that business as usual is not something that's good for the human race. It's not good for our families. It's not good for our neighbors. It's not good for our communities.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
it's
in the sharing of the stories and the power of the stories that can come to being. I think the work that you're doing is phenomenal. You know, when I started the Her Story movement, it's 2019. My vision was just to highlight the issues of women all over the world and help inspire, uplift, empower through the sharing of the stories. And then all of this happened. And it's just amazing what happens when people are heard, because when they tell you the story, in Africa, we believe that a problem shared is a problem halved. That the minute you tell somebody
Say that again, please.
A problem shared is a problem halved. That when you tell somebody your story, they carry it with you. It's no longer yours to carry alone. So a lot of our healing in Africa, we don't have psychologists. We don't have therapists. We talk, we share. And, you know, until I left Africa and came to live out in the Western world, I saw so much sadness, so much depression, so much disconnection in the Western society. Because people just don't talk to each other. You know, I moved to London when I was 19. And I remember I would go to the tube station or the bus station going to college. And I would greet someone and say, good morning. And I'd smile. And they would look through me like I did not exist. Like, why is she talking? Or they would react in a very, why are you talking to me kind of way. And I would phone my mom and say, Mom, I feel like I'm disappearing. They don't see me. So in Southern Africa, when we greet, we say Sabona. And Sabona means I see you. And it's not the seeing of sight. It's just my acknowledging your humanity and mine. And so that's the power of what you're doing with these stories. Every single person you have touched, you have halved their load. They know that their story is going to be amplified, is going to be read, it's going to warn, it's going to uplift, it's going to inspire, no matter how sad the story was.
Because we're all walking each other home.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you for your work, Michelle. Tell me, where do you see yourself 100 years from now? When you're sitting in your rocking chair and you've lived to 150 with technology and science, if you were to have a conversation with the future you, based on how you're living your life right now and what life has taught you up to this point, what would you say to that woman?
Well, it's so interesting because I think the 18-year-old Michelle was very wise and very unwise in some ways, but very wise in a way that answers your question. When I applied to college, one of my essays said, what are your goals for your life? And I said, my goal is, at the end of my life, to have a huge bowl of marbles, of experiences, of all different colors and stripes and flowing, beautiful ribbons in them. And that at the end of my life, I can tick each out marble and go, oh yeah, that was great. Or, oh yeah, that brought me to my knees, but then I learned. And so still the same, I think still the same as what that 18-year-old said. I hope at the end of my life that I have this huge bowl of gorgeous marbles, and meeting people all over the world is a big part of that.
Fantastic. Well, we need to bring you to New Zealand.
Yay!
Michelle, thank you so much for this uplifting story. And thank you to everybody who's tuned in today. The power of storytelling. We can change the world. One story at a time, one woman at a time. The Her Story Circle is about sharing, connecting, collaborating, empowering each other through the power of our stories and healing. Thank you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And have a fantastic day.
You too.
Wherever you are in the world. Bye for now.
If you like this podcast and would like to understand a little bit more about what was discussed, then you are in luck. Simply head over to the herstorycircle.com, where we have a fantastic bonus gift waiting for you to download. All we ask is that you leave a raving review. And lastly, help us share this podcast with your friends, your family, and your colleagues through Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram, and all your social media platforms. We really appreciate your support and look forward to seeing you again in our next episode. Thank you for listening to this podcast episode of the Her Story Circle. Once again, to get access to all the replays and future episodes, visit theherstorycircle.com and subscribe today. Thank you.